The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. Dare I say, spring is in the air? And it certainly feels like it in here. It's actually pretty warm in here, so I feel like I'm going to have to keep you awake. A little extra effort keeping you awake. But my name is Fusho. I'm a senior student here at the Village Zendo, and it's really nice to see everybody. I've been enjoying the study text for this Engo period, the Zen Echoes. It's been really refreshing. What a relief after reading lots of koans and verses and commentaries to hear from some of the female Zen masters. That's been really nice and inspiring. So for those of you that haven't read it or have, it's a rare collection of verse commentaries by three women Zen masters. One from the 12th century and the other two from 500 years later, in the 1600s. That was actually recorded and printed. And then not much else happened for hundreds of years until now. Never transcribed into English until now. So, I mean, it's about time, and it's exciting, and maybe that means something might be shifting a little bit. No, the translator Beta Grant, who is also quite inspiring, notes in her introduction that it's a collection of verses from women Chan masters that offer an eloquent illustration of the fact that in a religious milieu made up overwhelmingly of men, there were women who were just as dedicated to the Chan practice, or the Zen practice, just as advanced in their spiritual realization and just as gifted at using language to convey that which is beyond language. It's ironic that in Zen we read these texts and we work with these koans in order to get at something that we can't convey with words. But we do need these pointers and these tools that can help us while we're on the cushion. And it's always clear and always we're always reminded that as beautiful as these words might be, they are not the answer. Or as Chan Master Bao Qi, one of the three Zen masters in the text, says, the real Buddha sits within. By putting it into words, you've made a mistake. So here I am, all prepared, ready to make my mistake. I really like the title of the study text. The notion of Zen echoes is something that I've found happens naturally the more you study koans at all or read any Zen text. You hear echoes in the commentaries and you hear conversations happening in response to different koans. And so it becomes an ongoing conversation that we have inherited right here, right now. And we're always encouraged to take that conversation and turn towards it in our own lives and find out how to experience that in our own way so that it has some meaning and it becomes alive right now, right here. But if you're new to the practice or you're unfamiliar with the koans, you know, it can sound a little bit like gibberish or something really foreign and impossible to grasp or pretty confusing. I remember coming to listen to Dharma talks here for a quite a few years and really feeling like, I don't know what the hell that person's saying. I have no idea. It's something about it is moving me in some way, but I think they're speaking a different language. But the translator for Zen Echoes explains that koans are old records of lively encounters with great masters of the Tang Dynasty, beginning in the 9th century, going way back in China. And these selected accounts are often in the form of so-called encounter dialogues between master and disciple, or teacher and student, that came to be known as koans, which means literally public case or precedent. And so they were recorded, and then I think sometimes also they were created. You know, maybe not to be taken so literally ever. And in general, the verses or encounters were passed on in a way that's supposed to, this is me talking, snap us out of our rational, intellectual way of thinking and always point us towards our own experience of what we might want to call enlightenment, but that seems dangerous. You could call it emptiness, but sometimes that sounds scary. You could call it oneness. Vast, emptiness, or oneness, all of those work. I think the important thing to know is that we are really just able to use them as valuable guides towards finding our own answers on the cushion when we're meditating and in our daily lives for ourselves. So in that spirit, I'm going to talk about a koan that's not specifically found in Zen Echoes, but it's in the Blue Cliff record, and it's one that has been echoing with me a lot lately, so I can't let go of it, so I thought I'd talk about it. It's Chimin's Body of Wisdom. So the case is, a monk asked Chimin, what is the body of wisdom? And Chimin said, an oyster swallowing the moon. And the monk asked, what is the function of wisdom? And Chimin said, a rabbit getting pregnant. So that's my version of speaking another language or some kind of mystery conversation that I'm not part of is what it could sound like. It's poetic. Sounds beautiful. You could translate it as, what is the substance of wisdom? The body of wisdom is also known as the Dharmakaya. Or what is total enlightenment? Or you could ask, sometimes in Zen we say, what is not knowing? What is that? What is that not knowing? What is that vast emptiness? How do I attain it? What is it? How about just, what are we doing here? Why am I here on this cushion on an almost spring day, sitting, meditating, focusing, and then listening? What am I looking for? How do I find it? I think we all want to know all these things. So the verse response in the Blue Cliff record is, one piece of empty solidity beyond saying and feeling. From this, humans and gods see Subhuti. The oyster swallows the dark rabbit's deepest meaning. Having been given to Chan people, or Zen students, it makes them fight and struggle. So it keeps us awake, we hope. The case is, a monk asked Chimin, what is the body of wisdom? And Chimin said, an oyster swallowing the bright moon. And the monk asked, well, then what's the function of wisdom? And Chimin said, a rabbit getting pregnant. And it does take some work to find our own answers when you hear a response like that. The Chinese legend had it that the oyster would rise to the surface of the water during the full moon. And swallow some of the moonlight and create the pearl. And the other legend, or whatever you want to call it, Chinese story, fable, is that at the same time of autumn, when the moon was out, if it was full enough and bright enough, the rabbits would come out, and that's when they would mate and get pregnant. But what does that have to do with our body of wisdom? So often in Zen, the moon is a symbol for this truth or enlightenment. And I learned that the dark rabbit is a different name for the moon. And Subhuti, when the verse talks about Subhuti, as one of Buddha's disciples, is also known as the offspring of emptiness. And the story of Subhuti is that one day, in a mood of sublime emptiness, he was sitting under a tree and flowers began to fall on him. "We're praising you for the discourse upon emptiness," the gods whispered to him. And Subhuti said, "But I have not spoken of emptiness." "You have not spoken of emptiness, and we have not heard emptiness," responded the gods. "This is true emptiness." Or as we hear in Zen echoes, "No speaking and no hearing is true wisdom." And blossoms showered upon Subhuti as rain. See how Subhuti expounded wisdom so well without speaking of its body or its function? So what is this true wisdom? What is this knowing before knowing without speaking, far beyond deluded thoughts? Well, here we're encouraged to find our own answers by returning to the cushion and sitting with those deluded thoughts without pushing them away and without clinging to them, but by sitting with them, perhaps as the oyster sits in the murky water or the lotus in the murky water, inhaling with the thought, the deluded thought or the emotion, and exhaling with that thought or the emotion, allowing the space that seeps in while we sit with concentration, and slowly learn to relax into that space and perhaps set down those thoughts and emotions for just a minute, so that when we pick them back up, we can notice that they're different, or that they've changed a little bit, perhaps just a little bit, that they've been transformed. So for me, the rabbit getting pregnant was pretty straightforward in my mind. It's just a symbol of this constant transformation that is always happening, even when we don't see it, every minute, all the time. Before we were here, after we're here, it'll still be happening. Or that that slowly creating pearl that brings us back to the moonlight that's never stopped shining, not before we arrived in human form, not after. I can sometimes see the oyster swallowing the bright moon when I'm in this position or that position here, and I'm looking out at you on your cushions. And it's really beautiful. I can't see it happening in myself, because I don't think you can see it happening. And if you think you can, it's probably not it. But I can see it when we're all sitting and everybody is on the cushion. I can see you, oyster, swallowing the bright moon. And the moon is swallowing the moon. I know that's, now that we're getting into like stinky Zen talk. But I do think we let things go and return to that one piece of wisdom or vast emptiness. And that is what the practice helps us do. And it happens as we set our intention to sit. And it happens as we try. It happens when we don't try, when we think we're not getting it, or we're doing it wrong, or, "Oh, that was a really good sit." whatever we might think it is, it is always happening and we can always return to it. And our Zazen practice is the only way I know how to actively return to it or to come home to it and to slowly, ever so slowly, learn to practice it and to trust it. The trust for me was a tough one. So I think after about 12 years of practicing, I'm starting to trust it. It can take a long time. You know, it's not a world that makes it easy to let our guard down, and we need some of these various modes of self-defense and protections in order to function. And it's only human to think, how can I function without all these assets that I think protect me? Without these things, these qualities that make me me, who will I be? How could I possibly let go of those things and still be here as an oyster in the muck? Won't I lose myself? Won't my head fall off? It turns out, so far, I'm here to tell you no, you won't. As long as we have, you know, some good guidance, which we do have here at Village Zendo, and some good support. If we can trust it, an opening can occur. And if we can allow ourselves to relax within it, there's an opportunity to rest in that luminous moonlight, or even swallow it, and even remember that we are it. So how does it function? What is this deep meaning of the rabbit getting pregnant? Are we the offspring of oneness? Is it that our own true expression that can only be ours, no matter what we bring to the cushion each day, becomes something new and transformed? We sit on the cushion to reconnect and to polish whatever it might be that's making up our daily life, not to reject it, but to sit with it, and then hopefully make a little space around that. And our new, transformed, living, breathing selves get up off the cushion and go out into the world. Because in Zen, we don't cut ourselves off from the world. We do retreat, we filter, digest, let go, transform, and then we get up off the cushion. And we go out into our daily life. And we respond to each moment with as much presence as possible. Our teacher master Dogen Zenji wrote about this. The entire universe in the 10 directions is one bright pearl. A pearl is a new kind of shell, a different kind of strong surface formed of digesting our irritation, our suffering. It's perfect, without corners, nothing hidden. In practice, we turn our suffering into something clarified, whole. In this way, we become whole. And since it's not something we can express in words, I want to talk about oysters. I'm a big fan. I like to eat them. I also, I've been following this really interesting project that's taken hold in New York. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it's called the Billion Oyster Project. And a teacher at a school called the Harbor School on Governor's Island started this project, teaching students about the value of oysters in the ecosystem and like around the Hudson, in the bays, and all around in the waters, and how helpful they are. They filter the water for us. A lot of water. They can filter a lot of water in the right environment. So they sit literally in the murky water, and that's what they eat. And they take it in, and they sort it out, and they filter it. And then they add a little oxygen back, and they let go. And the water just keeps getting cleaner and cleaner as they do it. So the more they do this, then that kind of cleans up the ecosystem around them. And they also live in these sort of, kind of like a reef, because they live on each other. So they start to build these kind of almost barriers or seawall type of walls that protect from storms. They can protect, help with the tides. Little creatures can come in and live among the reefs of oysters. So it helps promote a whole clean ecosystem. So they've been working on getting these oysters back into the waters around the Hudson. Because when we first arrived about 400 years ago, there was millions of oysters in the waters, probably more than almost anywhere on Earth, all around the East Coast and the Hudson up here. And then everybody, I mean, they were like this common thing. It was like a hot dog stand was like oysters because they were just everywhere. And then we just started to eat too many of them, one, but two, pollute the water too much so that they actually couldn't survive. It can only survive in murky water until it gets to a point where it's just too polluted. And as soon as we started losing them, we knew we were in trouble. You know, the ecosystem got thrown off. And the water became really poisonous. So I think the Clean Air Act in the 70s helped change that a little bit. But it's going to be a slow process. But they have been starting oyster farms, and they've working with a bunch of restaurants in the city that return the used oyster shells to the ocean because that's what the other oysters live on. And it's turned into a big thing. There's schools all around the state are doing it. Cuomo's on board now, so the state's like, let's do this. And they're aiming for 1 billion oysters by 2035. And it's kind of, they're seeing some progress, so it's like a hopeful, exciting, regenerating thing. The oysters earn their nickname as ecosystem engineers. Because they're the key to maintaining the estuaries and the stable bottomland and clear water. And they said that a healthy oyster can pump 50 gallons of water a day through its gills. And it removes not only algae, but sediment. And if it's too much, like it's taking in, it's like too much stuff that it can't really process, it makes a little package, and it like puts it on the outside of itself. It's just like its little case. It just sets it in the bottom of the ocean or the river or wherever. So they have all kinds of benefits. These little creatures sit in the dirty water and filter it and flourish on this mucky water and clean it up. So I am going to say I think it's a nice way to look at sitting on the cushion. Instead of this brilliant, amazing idea of what enlightenment might be, what if we just allow ourselves to sit in our meditation and allow this filtration process to happen naturally, which it does. It can help us settle our mind, settle our thoughts. Maybe when we let that go, instead of the clear water, we have a little clear air, clear spaciousness that we go back out into the world with. And I think then our bodhisattva selves will naturally emerge. Can we trust that we already are the oyster swallowing the bright moon? Can we allow ourselves to know what we already know? To have what we already have? To continue to let ourselves become the rabbit getting pregnant? There is some additional verse commentary for this case in the Blue Cliff Record. It says, haven't you heard how Pan Shan said, the mind moon is solitary and full. Its light engulfs the myriad forms. The light is not shining on objects, nor do the objects exist. Light and objects both forgotten. Then what is this? But not to get lost in the void, I just want to point out that the Blue Cliff record, and many times in different koans, reminds us, how could it not be you? And Fa Yen's verse on perfect reality says, when reasoning is exhausted, saying and feeling are forgotten, how could this properly be described? Since it can't be properly described, we can find echoes of answers to these questions everywhere we look. Hopefully we find them when we sit on the cushion or when we go into the interview room. And hopefully we bring our own response and our own experience and our own answers with us. A modern day Zen master who didn't know he was one, probably, the poet E.E. Cummings, I think echoed this koan in his poem. It's called Crepuscule, which means twilight. He said, I will wait out till my thighs are steeped in burning flowers. I will take the sun in my mouth and leap into the ripe air, alive with closed eyes, to dash against darkness in the sleeping curves of my body, shall enter fingers of smooth mastery with chasteness of sea girls. Will I complete the mystery of my flesh? I will rise after 1,000 years, lipping flowers, and set my teeth in the silver of the moon. And the commentary in the Blue Cliff record says, these verses too make you see one piece of empty solidity beyond saying and feeling. And our third Zen master, manly man, female Zen master, Master Bauchi, wrote a verse in response to a different case, but I still think it's echoing this. She says, from the void he plucks a flower. In the water he floats the moon. The crime that has filled the universe, how can one explain it in words? So I'm going to end with my own verse commentary on the oyster swallowing the moon and offer a Zen echo right here at 588 Broadway. On the cushion, drenched in moonlight, flowers fall with no place to land. Off the cushion, she walks out into the bright sunshine, before movement or direction, embracing the tumble of expression. Without looking back or leaning forward, it's already here.